Fourth case of the day, the United States v. Hassebrouck. Mr. Hughes?
May it please the court, counsel for the government, my name is Craig Hughes. I represent the defendant appellant in this case, Orville Dwayne Hassebrouck. In this case, the district court erred when it denied Mr. Hassebrouck's timely asserted motions for judgment of acquittal, as well as his motion for new trial. Particularly, the record in the case indicates that Special Agent Richard Dutzel of the Internal Revenue Service testified that IRS records indicated that Mr. Hassebrouck, in August, I believe, of 2005, had filed an extension, a form asking for an extension of time to file his 2004 tax return and asking that that deadline be extended to October the 15th of 2005. There was also testimony by Special Agent Dutzel that that application for extension had, in fact, been accepted by the IRS, and the application was admitted as an exhibit in the case for the jury to consider. Thus, the evidence that was presented to the jury was that Mr. Hassebrouck had, in fact, been granted an extension to file his 2004 income tax return. Well, if that was the case, then he could not have been in violation of Section 7203 by failing to file his return by April the 15th, 2005, if the deadline had been extended. Therefore, with respect to the judgment for acquittal, pursuant to count two of the indictment, the willful failure to file, that motion should have been granted in its entirety. Now, with respect to count one of the indictment, the evasion count, the government alleged numerous manner and means by which Mr. Hassebrouck committed the act of tax evasion, among them being that he had failed to file a tax return by April the 15th of 2005, his 2004 tax return. At a bare minimum, the district court should have granted the motion for judgment of acquittal with respect to that theory of liability, that he had the affirmative act he had committed to find him guilty of evasion was failing to file his tax return. Now, we concede that the government alleged other affirmative acts that the jury could have considered in determining whether or not Mr. Hassebrouck was guilty of evasion. But at a bare minimum, the district court should have instructed the jury, should have granted the motion, instructed the jury that in determining whether or not he had committed the offense of evasion, that they could not consider the fact that he had not filed his tax return by April the 15th of 2005. And I think it's important to point out that there was no evidence to refute or rebut the testimony of Special Agent Dutzel. No one from the IRS told the jury that this application for extension of time had in fact been denied or had never been filed. So the only evidence before the jury indicated that the application had been filed and had been accepted. Now, further confusing the issue is the special verdict that the jury returned, the special verdict form that I'm sure the court is familiar, where the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Hassebrouck willfully failed to file his individual income tax return for 2004 on or before April the 15th of 2005, but that they did not find beyond a reasonable doubt that he had willfully failed to file his income tax return for 2004 on or before October the 15th of 2005.
It's not clear to me why the questions were asked in that way.
In all honesty, Your Honor, it's not clear as well, and I'm hoping that the government would perhaps, I believe Mr. Quinley may have been present at trial, and perhaps that can be clarified.
So you were not counsel below?
I was not counsel below.
And
I was not.
There was no discussion on the record that you are familiar with that explained why that special verdict form was being used?
It's been a little bit of time since I reviewed the record, Your Honor, but I don't recall there was a lot of clarity as to why that form was submitted. It strikes me as being very confusing because I think what's happened is it's rendered an inconsistent verdict. For instance, obviously, April the 15th of 2005 falls before October the 15th of 2005. So it's almost as if the jury is saying, well, yes, you did, and no, you didn't. I think A more artful drafting would have said, do you find that it was filed after April the 15th, but before October the 15th? But it's our position that these two answers are inconsistent, and that the answer particularly, special verdict number two, is inconsistent with the jury's finding of guilt as to count two, because they found, apparently, that that Mr. Hassebrock did not willfully fail to file.
So they found that he willfully failed to file on April 15th, his
correct.
Return when due, but that he didn't willfully fail to file in October.
That's correct. And the evidence was presented that an extension had been granted.
Well, I thought it was that an extension had been reviewed.
I believe the exact language from Agent Dutzel, Your Honor, was that it had been accepted. And the extension form itself...
Allowed? Maybe?
Actually, the extension form itself that's at Appendix 47 of our appendix, there is a line, we have approved your application. Again, that's at A47 of our appendix. It's my understanding that that was a hotly contested issue at trial, but be that as it may, the jury's being told by an IRS agent, I've reviewed the records, there is an extension. The extension form that they saw says we have approved your application. I believe there was also testimony from Mr. Sam Phillips, who was Mr. Hassebrock's CPA, that he had assisted Mr. Hassebrock in preparing that application for an extension of time.
And I take it the defense was that approval related back to the April 15th duty.
That's correct. That when this extension was granted, when this application extension was granted.
I'm assuming that the jury believed that that's what happened.
That's correct.
I mean, that was hotly disputed,
I agree. And assuming the jury believed that that's what happened. And I think it's important to note that at the time in 2004, as IRS procedure, the law stands now, you can file for one automatic extension of 6 months. At that time, it was only for 4 months until August the 15th of the next year. And then after August the 15th, you could ask for an additional two-month extension for good cause shown. So the application...
Oh, that explains it.
Okay.
And
so the application filed by Mr. Asper, this was not an automatic extension. There would have to be a good cause shown. But be that as it may, again, there was no evidence brought forward by the IRS that we didn't approve this, that it wasn't filed. So it's our position that that no rational trier of fact could have found other than that the extension had been granted. And if that's the case, then Mr. Hassebrock did not violate Section 7203 by willfully failing to file by April the 15th of 2005 because his deadline had been extended. If I may move on to the procedural and the substantive reasonableness of the sentence in this case, the record's clear that when the U.S. Probation Office submitted the pre-sentence report, they arrived at a base guideline level of 20 under the federal sentencing guidelines, and that was based on a alleged tax loss somewhere in the neighborhood, I believe, of $650,000. Now, if you refer to Section 2T1.1 of the U.S. Sentencing Guidelines, that section instructs that in a tax evasion case that involves failure or willful failure to file, that the tax loss shall, I believe the government agrees with us that this is, in fact, a correct statement of the law, that the correct manner in calculating the tax loss is 20% of the gross income for the taxable year. I don't think there's much dispute, and given the amount that the government alleged in the indictment, that Mr. Hassebrock's taxable income for the year 2004 was a little bit over, barely over $2 million. 20% then would yield a tax loss, a specific tax loss of $406,460.74. Now, that is extremely important because there is a threshold at $400,000 that bumps this up to a level 20. The record also, and the government acknowledges and admits that 20% calculation is the way it's calculated. Now, it's critically important in this case, the record reflects that in May of 2005, when the IRS executed a search warrant at Mr. Hassebrock's home, they discovered approximately There was some dispute as to the amount, but somewhere in the neighborhood of $11,000 in a safe. I believe at some point Mr. Hassebrock submitted that it was a greater amount, but approximately $11,000 in cash in a safe, as well as some gold coins and some other assets. The government seized that money, and I think we can presume that that money was applied to Mr. Hassebrock's tax debt for 2004. Now, obviously, if you just
take... It's not going to make any difference because the guidelines look to attempted or intended loss, right?
Well,
not the ultimate loss once you offset whatever was seized in the...
Well, search warrant. I understand. I think in this case, given the specific instruction of Section 2T1 that says you take the 20% of the gross income, when the evasion case involves failure to file, it's our position that the loss was properly calculated at $406,000, but he simply wasn't given credit for the $11,000 or so.
Yeah, the guidelines don't require that he be given credit, because they look to attempted or intended loss, not ultimate loss. Ultimate loss may be relevant for restitution and other purposes, but not for the guidelines.
Well,
and
you're
in level 20 with the 406, right?
I believe, but I would still beg to differ that he is entitled to some type of credit for the $11,000.
Guidelines don't work that way.
Okay.
Now, are you going to address your multiplicity lesser included offense argument?
It was low on my list, Your Honor. If I could move to one further, if I may. With respect to the restitution order, again, I think the government has conceded that in a Title 26 tax case, ordering restitution is not proper. We've cited this court's precedent in Hoover, and in Hoover, the Miniman precedent was cited. Now, the government asserts that the government can get around, or rather the court can get around, this prohibition against a restitution order in a tax case by making it either a condition of probation or a condition of supervised release. Now, in this case, obviously, Mr. Hassebrock was not granted and is not on probation. He's currently incarcerated. As far as the restitution, which, by the way, was close to $1 million in this case, I believe approximately $997,000, it was... The judgment is clear that that was not imposed as a condition of supervised release. I believe there's a specific provision in the government that sets forth the conditions of supervised release, and that is not one. So we would argue that imposing that amount of restitution in this case was improper. And I notice it's time for my rebuttal. I'm getting in my rebuttal, so I'll yield to Mr. Quinley.
Here's Mr. Quinley.
Thank you, Your Honors. I suppose I could go backwards. Should we take the restitution first? I mean, I think clearly the court has the authority, statutory authority, to order as a condition of either probation, and then it's incorporated for supervised release. You can do the same conditions for supervised release. I think the only question is, can the government begin collecting on the court's order of restitution right away?
Right.
And, right? I mean, that's the question. And why not? It's
calculated?
A lawful part of the sentence. Pardon?
How was that amount calculated? That seems it's more than loss. I don't.
Well, actually, let's get back to that point about the 20% guideline. The guideline says 20% of the gross income, or what is more accurately calculated. Well, we had Sam Phillips from Mr. Hassebrock himself, who calculated about $599,000 as being the estimated tax liability that would be owed for 2004. And then we had revenue agent Michael Gilmore, who made allowance for all manner of possible expenses and came up with a tax liability of $593,514. And then added to that was the interest from April 15th to the date of sentencing, which was calculated by the revenue agent and supplied to the probation officer. They didn't include penalties, but they included the statutory interest that the IRS is entitled to a debt to the IRS based upon the $593,000 $514 that the revenue agent calculated was due and owing on April the 15th. So that's how you get to the $900,000 plus.
So that so there's 400 some thousand in interest.
That's correct. Because Mr. Hassebrock has never paid anything on this. And so let me just address the 11,000 if I can. Of course, there's claims of gold coins and silver coins and what have you. But, again, this isn't the forum to address that. And what was reported from the search warrant was the 11,000 in currency, which was applied to an existing debt to the Internal Revenue Service. In fact, the evidence at trial, of course, was that the Internal Revenue Service was in the process of trying to levy any accounts of Mr. Hassebrock and his wife in order to collect on that existing debt. And, of course, that was important evidence as to the willfulness of the conduct. So I think I'm done with that last bit. So let me move backwards. And now I'll start back to where Mr. Hughes started. The language he quotes from the transcript is from the representative of the Revenue Center was that, and if you turn, Your Honors, to the very last page in the government's brief, here's this form that came into evidence that the government introduced. And the language was, quote, had been accepted. Now, it's a line, there's a line on the transcript, the computer record, that shows this extension. And frankly, that's all that's at the IRS Revenue Center. We were able to recover this document in a different fashion. But as you see, the document has these, it has Sam Phillips' signature on it. It does not have the taxpayer's signatures. It has no reason stated. Well, it says more time is requested to acquire all the information needed to complete and file an accurate return. All right, so that is indicated. And then it says, have you filed Form 4868 to request an automatic extension to file for this tax year? Now, there's a mark through yes, and there's a X with a circle around it in no. And, of course, the transcript with the IRS and the clear testimony of the representative of the service center was, no request for an extension had been filed on or before April 15th. And Sam Phillips testified, the CPA that Mr. Hassebrock went to ask him, gee, how much would I owe if this $2.5 million settlement that I got $1.7 million of was included in the tax? And Mr. Phillips' clear testimony was he didn't ask me to actually file a return before April 15th, and he didn't ask me to file an extension for him before April the 15th.
Why was the special verdict form structured the way it was?
Let me address that, Your Honor. At the close of the government's evidence, the defense strongly argued for, had a well-prepared and laid-out argument, that the government's proof was at variance from the indictment. It was a variance argument that the indictment should have said not April 15th, but should have said October 15th. Or I suppose there are other ways you could indict a case to say, or at such other date as the law required. But in this instance, and the court so found, the law required filing by April 15th. You can't, and we briefed this, we had case authority on this, and this isn't even raised in the appeal, or we would have put the same cases in for this court, that basically you can't retroactively undo an obligation that the point in time, unless that point's been changed, and you can't change it retroactively, unless something had been done before April 15th, the obligation was April 15th.
Right.
And the judge decided that.
So why did the judge?
Because the judge wasn't sure of his decision at that point.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, But the judge wanted to have guidance after the jury returned its verdict of guilty.
Well, that invited
confusion. But there's no confusion here because, frankly, the defense argued strenuously. You can review Mr. Lucco's closing argument that Mr. Hassebrock had no obligation to file on April the 15th. That was the defense argument on the merits of the case. And as the government pointed out, as I pointed out, no, he did fail to file by April 15th, and that is the crime that was committed, and that's what this evidence shows. So frankly, you know, as a matter of linguistics, Mr. Hughes can object, but frankly, the jury told the court exactly what it had done. It had followed the instruction of law. It didn't. The instructions didn't give an option. No, the instruction said the element was willfully failure to file on or before April 15th, and the jury said, yeah, we found that beyond a reasonable doubt. And no, we did not find something else, this business about honor that he had failed to file on or before October 15th.
But there isn't any legal basis to give the second special verdict question to the jury.
Well, it's harmless, Your Honor, because it was done after the jury deliberated and returned its guilty verdict. So it didn't create any confusion during the deliberation on the guilt or innocence of the defendant.
There was a general verdict first?
Yes.
And then the jury was asked
after
to answer
After they had returned their verdict of guilty, then the special verdict was submitted to them at the court's instruction because the court was curious.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I mean, that's... And it was, again, not because of what argument's been made here about sufficiency, but it was because the argument was that the government has failed to indict the crime that was committed. And that trying to submit now on October 15th would be a fatal variance in the indictment, that you can't amend an indictment. And, of course, the government's position was, no. There was no effective continuance. In fact, that's what was strenuously argued, basically. Yes, he says it had been accepted, but, frankly, all that means is, yes, it appears here on the transcript. And the stray mark here where it says we have approved your application with no signatures by the director, I'm not sure it indicates anything. It's the argument of counsel that therefore this had been granted. Now, we argued to the court it doesn't matter whether they granted it or not. His crime was complete on April 16th. But the truth of the matter is who knows with this extension. And again, the case law in this circuit is clear. The accepting of payment later doesn't obviate the evasion that was already completed. The same thing is true that if they accepted a return later, which they never did, even though one was submitted in 2008, it doesn't obviate the failure to file at this time. And, in fact, even after the search warrant, the testimony, Mr. Phillip, it's cited here in the record, was even after the search warrant, he didn't ask him to prepare a return for 2004. He asked him to prepare one for his wife only, and that it wasn't until 2006 that he even discussed with Mr. Phillips the preparation of a return for 2004. So is this novel? And maybe the court might want to discourage the use of unnecessary special verdicts. But it's harmless, at least on these facts. Now, let's see. Oh, and on the second thing, trying to extend this also to count one, the evasion. Actually, you know, Mr. Hughes keeps calling the failure to file one of the affirmative acts. Well, it's pled in the indictment because in order to have a Spies evasion, you have to have a failure to file. But the law is clear. The affirmative acts are the affirmative acts actually pled. There was even a unanimity instruction given to the jury specifying what the two affirmative acts pled in the indictment were. The diversion of funds to nominee accounts, whether it's a trust for the children or the checking account put in the name of the son, or the land purchased in the names of the son and the daughter, I think those were the three uses. It's not the attorney's trust account. That was just an intermediary step. The final destination to get it out of the reach of the tax collector was for these very substantial taxes that Mr. Phillips had told him he would owe on this settlement. Most of it went into this trust for the children, and the $100,000 isn't about the attorney's trust. Out of this trust for the children that was set up and funded, he directed $100,000 to be paid to Mr. Bernhoff, this new tax attorney from Wisconsin that he hired because of these problems. So there was really nothing on count one at all, and I'd submit not much on count two on the failure to file. Now, you know, I'm not sure what else was addressed. Case law in this district is absolutely clear on multiplicity and duplicity. I mean, the count two, the failure file, is a separate offense in this district.
How is that reconcilable with Sansone?
I don't know.
That's a concession on the part of the government.
No, it's not a concession on the part of the government. I'm going to have to be honest with you. You're referring to Sansone, and I don't know.
It's the Supreme Court case that says that failure to file offense is a lesser included offense, or can be a lesser included offense of the tax evasion.
Yes, and some circuits have so found, but not the Seventh Circuit.
Right. That's my question. Are we wrong?
I don't think so. I think I go back to Blockberger and just the application.
You're missing the question. Yeah, the Blockberger test is okay here. There's not a per se multiplicity problem because we've got different elements. But in a particular case, and this is the thrust of the Sansone opinion, in a particular case, the facts might give rise to the necessity of giving a lesser included offense instruction that the failure to file offense is a lesser included offense of evasion. So if the government has charged evasion standing alone, then the lesser included offense instruction must be given based on the facts. Or if the government has charged both, then if the defendant is convicted of both, the failure to file offense needs to be vacated. You can't convict and sentence for multiplicitous
Well,
crimes.
But okay, that would just be the additional punishment question. Right.
Right.
But
that's the double jeopardy.
Right, right. And frankly, I think that even though they are separate offenses, well, look, we charged both offenses, following Foster, following the authority in this circuit.
Right.
And I don't think I missed it if it's there. I don't think we're at the point yet where anyone has said, and forgive me because
it's in a footnote in the defendant's brief that, you know, one of the offenses has got to go. This is in the section on multiplicity. But it wasn't raised below. We're on a plain error standard.
But is that particular to, forgive me, Your Honor, is that particular to tax offenses? I mean, that would be true if it were, in fact, a lesser included.
Right. And that's why the Sansone case is relevant, that and the Supreme Court said that in appropriate circumstances, the failure to file offense is a lesser-included offense of the evasion charge. The evasion charge is sort of the big kahuna in the tax code, right? And then there are all kinds of other offenses
Well,
that
I'm
going
to have to apologize because I missed it. And
I don't blame you because it wasn't briefed in precisely this way.
Well, but if it's in a footnote, I still should have reviewed it. In fact, it's probably in the stack of cases there, but I certainly missed that.
It's a subset of the multiplicity argument. But your opposing counsel didn't raise it in his argument here, and it's a plain error review. So.
Well, I think,
sweat it.
You know, Your Honor, let me address the substantive part of the reasonable challenge. You know, I think you've had an opportunity to see Judge Reagan's statements on the record at the time of sentencing, and he tried to fashion a guideline sentence that reflected the overall seriousness for these two crimes, which of course are one course of conduct, and I don't think, unless the Supreme Court requires otherwise, that the additional 4 months should be set aside, because I think Judge Reagan, and if the court
That's the remedy if they truly were multiplicitous.
Well, that's true, Your Honor, but I think that the court should really consider then whether Judge Reagan would want to refashion his sentence, because he made a very important point about the need for deterrence with this kind of conduct. And I have to say, we're confronting it over and over again, and as I look around the country, I mean, what the Sentencing Commission said in its commentary is absolutely true. And the particular individual will never accept any judicial authority. But so general deterrence is punishment, and general deterrence is all we can accomplish.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Quinley.
Thank you, Your Honors, and my apology again on the case. At least I made the mistake yesterday of not acknowledging that I had not read a particular case, and that's been troubling me since then till now. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hughes?
Briefly, Your Honors, if I may, with respect to the multiplicity argument, the lesser included issue, I believe the court has clearly recognized there is a circuit split. This circuit appears to be in the minority, but be that as it may, there is a circuit split as to whether or not failure to file is, in fact, a lesser included of evasion. We presented that issue potentially for future review. I'd like to get back, just if I could, with respect to the restitution order. The government once again has asserted that the restitution was ordered as a condition of supervised release, and I think that a review of the judgment in this case, where terms and conditions of supervised release are set forth, that is not listed in that section. There's just simply a award of restitution to the IRS in an amount approaching $1 million. And therefore, by not specifically including the payment of restitution as a condition of supervised release, that the award was improper and it should be vacated.
So, well, that would just result in a remand, I suspect, right?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, yes.
If Judge Reagan made it a condition of supervised release, you would not have any quarrel?
Well,
I don't mean with the amount.
Okay,
I mean with the authority.
Right. I think that I'm sorry, could you please state that again, Your Honor? I apologize.
Well, I understand the distinction you're making of when it might be applicable. So I guess you would be calling for a remand on that?
That's correct. And because clearly I think the precedent is clear that it cannot be awarded in a Title 26 tax case. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you both, counsel. The case is taken under advisement and the court will proceed.